Hello, good people. Welcome to Friedrich Nietzsche's The Antichrist, or an analysis of it, rather. And today I'm going to be going into the preface for three main reasons. One, it's the preamble to the actual text, and that's alone a reason we should read it. Secondly, it's written by Friedrich Nietzsche, and if you're at all familiar with philosophy, you are familiar with the name Friedrich Nietzsche. He's an absolutely bombastic, arrogant... Well, a lot of people would consider him to be an evil person. Depending on what camp you're in, he either lives in infamy or fame, but nonetheless, you feel of one camp about him. I've never met one person who feels, about Friedrich Nietzsche. He always evokes this strong, passionate emotion, be it love or hatred. Even if you don't necessarily agree with all that he says, and by God, it's hard to. Not especially, but very much so in this book that we're about to read, The Antichrist, this little over 100-page essay of why exactly he hates Christianity and Western culture along with it. I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. But ultimately, we have the preface here. Oh, and of course the final reason being that in this preface, he details exactly who he wants his idyllic reader to be. And that's important, or if not important, it's interesting for any text that you go into, not just philosophical, but nonetheless, the preface. This book belongs to the most rare of men. I mean, that's already an incredible line. Friedrich Nietzsche was one of the greatest prose poets the German language has ever had, and it really shows in all of his work, not just The Antichrist, but he gets very biblical and flowery and poetic in his language, and it's just beautiful to decipher and look through. But no matter. This book belongs to the most rare of men. That's a line that carries the same sort of gravitas as Call Me Ishmael, which doesn't have the same gravitas as the actual first line of the book, Let Us Look Each Other in the Face, We Are Hyperboreans, which in itself is a great line. And I swear to God, this is not going to be however long this is me on my knees for Nietzsche. But moving on. It just means that this book is written to the upper echelon of society, the most special, the most rare of men. And the next line accentuates that point. Perhaps not one of them is yet alive. This person that I'm looking for, this person that I'm writing to, is so high up on the social hierarchy, so high up in the intellectual, has such an intellectual integrity, some might even say to the verge of hardness, that they might not even be alive. I may be looking for someone who doesn't even exist. That's how specific I'm being. It is possible that they may be among those who understand my Zarathustra. How could I confound myself with those who are now sprouting ears? So Zarathustra is obviously a reference to Nietzsche's book, which, again, lives in either fame or infamy, depending on what camp you're in. Thus spake Zarathustra, which a lot of SS guards carried with them into battle. It's an incredible book, and one in which he mentions the Übermensch for the first time and all of these various Nietzschean ideas, which we are very familiar with nowadays. But nonetheless, if you read and understood my Zarathustra, perhaps you could understand this. And if you read and understood my Zarathustra, well, you are just now sprouting ears. And that's another theme that we are going to see heavily throughout this preface, is that theme of rebirth. And so if you understood my previous work, perhaps you will understand this one. Or how could I confound myself, rather, with those who have already become tuned to how exactly I work, how exactly I create my philosophical texts. Again, a very full language Nietzsche is using. First, the day after tomorrow must come for me. Some men are born posthumously. Now, these are personally my favorite two lines in the entirety of the preface, and they end the first paragraph. First, the day after tomorrow must come for me. Some men are born posthumously. First, the day after tomorrow must come for me. Tomorrow, in this instance, meaning death. So first, a time after death must come for me, must greet me, or my ideas, rather. Some men are born posthumously. I love that line. So obviously not literally. People are not reborn literally, but their ideas are reborn. They go through a kind of renaissance. They have impact after their death, hence why we study history. Their ideas carry on further than they do. Their works carry on further than they do, and they undergo a sort of cultural rebirth, a cultural renaissance. And the Nietzschean Renaissance is nothing if not very, very real. In fact, almost immediately after his death, his work skyrocketed in popularity and, well, just a growing body of hatred around his work, scholarly hatred. But nonetheless, it was getting the recognition that it deserves for having so profound a thinker. Absolutely fascinating. The conditions under which anyone understands me, and necessarily understands me, I know them only too well. Even to endure my seriousness, my passion, he must carry intellectual integrity to the verge of hardness. He must be accustomed to living on mountaintops, and to looking upon the wretched gabble of politics and nationalism as beneath him. Okay, so that's quite the chunk there. What does it all mean? So the conditions under which anyone understands me and necessarily understands me. So by the conditions, he means his own line of work. Any book in the Nietzschean canon that you go and dig deep into is almost... it's kind of a labyrinthine structure of challenges. It's this whole maze. It's this puzzle that Nietzsche is setting out for his readers. He's one of the few authors that I know ever to do this, and he mentions the labyrinth later on down here. But it's just this idea of, I am challenging the reader. I dare you to understand me. I dare you to interpret me in the correct way, in the way that I intended. And maybe he didn't intend for a correct way. God knows that his work has carried on for the sole reason alone that his work is open to interpretation. But regardless, so... it's just fascinating, the conditions under which anyone understands me and necessarily understands me, I know them only too well. Why do I know them only too well? Well, because of course I pour so much of myself into my work that if someone were to understand, they would have the same sort of mental mapping, mental framework that I do. I would know them like the back of my hand because I pour so much of myself into this work. Again, if they understand this work, they necessarily understand me. Fascinating. And now there are a whole hell of a lot of theories out there talking about how Nietzsche was a Nazi. Even though this is how he was widely regarded, this is not the case. And we don't know this for a fact, obviously, hence why the theories are still out there, but it has been largely, largely disproven. In fact, he hated Nazis and anti-Semitism specifically. He fell out with his closest friend Wagner, as well as his sister, who married a Nazi. And unfortunately, he had to go back into her care after... he lost his mind, actually, shortly after the completion of this book, but nevertheless, this is not a lecture about that. But anyways, what I mean when I refer to all of that is, he must look upon the wretched gabble of politics and nationalism as beneath him. Nationalism and politics, politics and nationalism, are both, of course, staples of fascism and Nazism. And so, nationalism and politics, they envelop a person. They take charge of the entire person's mind, their identity, their ideology, everything about them. It suddenly becomes centered around this nationalistic political spectrum. And Nietzsche hates that because it obstructs from the reality that we currently live in. That's another critique he has of Christianity. It's all of this menial nothingness which is distracting from the true purpose of humankind, which is not really a purpose per se, but just the caring for and existing upon the rock that we are currently on. Why do we keep looking into the distance for this heaven, this hell, this life after, when we have this perfectly good life here that we need to make the best of? That's a huge critique of Christianity that Nietzsche has, and nationalism and politics embody that slightly, hence why he's attacking them here. He must have become indifferent. He must never ask of the truth whether it brings profit to him or a fatality to him. He must have an inclination born of strength for questions that no one has the courage for. The courage for the forbidden. Predestination for the labyrinth. Okay, so there's a little bit there. He must have become indifferent, yada yada. Again, all of this stuff that we talked about previously. All of this social framework. Frameworking, I should say. And the reason for that is because Nietzsche criticizes Christianity, but in doing so, he also condemns Western culture, because Christianity is so unbelievably insidious and so unbelievably pervaded throughout Western culture that it has become Western culture. We now live in a culture of shame, guilt, and pity, and we must toss away all of those values, if we are to step through into the path of enlightenment, if we are to step through into the path of Nietzschean enlightenment, specifically. Fascinating stuff. So, he must have become indifferent, he must be resolute in his own ideas and in himself, the confidence within himself, which we will see here shortly. But he must never ask of the truth whether it brings profit to him or a fatality to him. It's that also ties in with the entire idea of imploring God for something. Something else must be tied to your fate, whatever that means. Your free will, even. The notion that fate even exists is disregarding responsibility. And Nietzsche hates that wholeheartedly. Predestination for the labyrinth. And so what that means is that, and this sort of idea of predestination is mentioned further on with the word foreordained, And it's the idea that if you have these qualities, you are almost predestined to pick up this book or pick up this path to enlightenment, enter into the labyrinth once more. Because the entire idea is that, as we'll see when we actually get into the first page of the Antichrist, the labyrinth, humanity is on a constant path through the labyrinth. And you can draw that parallel. That's fairly easy to deduce. We are all on our path through towards something. We are bleeding through adversity, but for what? And this word enlightenment, it's very vague and it has very many possible meanings, which is why so many different religions have formed around the central concept of enlightenment. But Nietzsche is using that very same labyrinth, that bleeding through adversity on the path to enlightenment, that same parody of Christianity and many other religions to talk about his own vision, his own prophetic vision. And so someone who has all of these attributes was predestined for the labyrinth to actually make it through. Oh, and to finish my thought, the entire idea of this enlightenment, as well as the labyrinth, is that Christianity is this faux enlightenment. It's this fake enlightenment which has trapped people on their path to real enlightenment. And so people, midway through the labyrinth, get this idea of, oh, well, of course, there's this heaven, and there's this afterlife, and there's a reason why all of these things are happening. And it's this big father in the sky, which is looking over us. It's this comforting thought. That's what religion is. It's a giant comforting thought. It's a giant orphan complex, almost, if you were to put it in a Freudian terminology. But Nietzsche says, no. Let's cast away that lazy lack of resolution, and let's carry on through to the path of true enlightenment, which we'll see as he details here in the first page of the Antichrist, looking at the actual Hyperborean and what that means. But anyways, the experience of seven solitudes, new ears for new music, new eyes for what is most distant, a new conscience for truths that have hitherto remained unheard, and the will to economize in the grand manner, to hold together his strength, his enthusiasm, reverence for self, love of self, absolute freedom of self. Absolutely fascinating, that chunk there. And it also harkens back to an earlier bit in the first paragraph of the preface where he talks about that rebirth. Earlier, he talks about the rebirth of self, his own rebirth, his own intellectual rebirth, which he was astoundingly right about. Almost immediately after his death, his work skyrocketed in popularity. But here we have a rebirth of the reader, because again, it's that theme that in order to pick up this book, in order to pick up and truly absorb this Nietzschean canon, you must first go through this rebirthing process so that you are not conditioned, so that you are not absorbed and taken in by this fake moral acid of Western society, and by extension, Christianity, or I should say Christianity, and by extension, Western society. And he picks on Christianity here. There are many religions which share themes of Christianity that Nietzsche dislikes, but he picks on Christianity here as it's being a theistic superpower. Christianity also has a big role in Nietzsche's life. He was brought up in an extremely Lutheran household, and he actually went to school for this Christian theology. This biblical theology. He was very well versed in the Abrahamic faiths, and he was very well versed in all of the classical texts. So it may... this entire book, this entire Nietzschean series of writings may just be a giant rebellious phase. It's like teenage years carried on to infinity, to his dying day. It is interesting, though. He does have the arrogance and bombastic personality, as I've mentioned, of a teenager in that way. And God, is it irritating at some points. But his indignation is intensely likable. Anyways, so here, the word that comes in constantly is new. New ears for new music, new eyes for what is most distant, a new conscience for truths that have hitherto remained unheard. So new is the new word. And the reason for that is because, of course, the whole entire idea of rebirth is completely about coming into the new. You need to have these new appendages, these new consciences, in order to absorb the work that I'm spouting, and not have it change you ever so slightly, but fully transform who you are as a person. Listen to this, fully open, all preconceived notions out the window, and then maybe, I can convince you that I am right, which I most definitely am. Excellent. And these lines down here, reverence for self, love of self, absolute freedom of self. So even in this rebirthing process, we're talking about that resolute nature of holding yourself to a higher esteem. Because Nietzsche sees Christianity as being, of course, this moral acid, whatever even morality and virtue mean anymore, not related to Christianity. But he sees Christianity itself as this insidious force which goes into the person and corrupts from within, makes you think that you are somehow the problem, and forces you into this weaker rung of humanity. But no, Nietzsche says, we need the naturalistic, we need the warrior class, we need our savages back, not only physically, but intellectually. And Christianity has destroyed all of that through this sort of self-denigration. And so carry with you a reverence of self, love of self, absolute freedom of self. Excellent. Very well then. Of that sort only are my readers, my true readers, my readers foreordained, there's that word. Of what account are the rest? The rest are merely humanity. One must make oneself superior to humanity in power, in loftiness of soul, in contempt. Absolutely fascinating. That last paragraph is pretty self-explanatory, but I'll just go over it briefly here. So, very well then. Of that sort only are my readers, of course, this higher class of man, this reborn intellectual Übermensch, this person with intellectual integrity to the verge of hardness. My true readers, my readers foreordained, and there's that word which matches with predestination, that idea that these views which I'm about to spout are so few and far between that were you to have them, it's almost as though we were predestined for each other. It's almost as though fate has binded us together in this revolution against Christianity, in this transvaluation of the transvaluation. Excellent. The rest are merely humanity. So I have my little enclave of Nietzschean soldiers. Who are the rest? Merely humanity. And even though this book appeals to that rest, to that humanity, in hopes to convert them, Nietzsche knows that the likelihood of this actually taking hold within his lifetime is very slim, and so he's holding on to the little enclave, the little base that he has, and holding on to it passionately. Again, this is not just the general reader, this is the idyllic reader. This is the absolute upper echelon of what Nietzsche has in store, or in mind, rather, for who he wants his reader to be. Fascinating. And so, one must make oneself superior to humanity in power and loftiness of soul, in contempt. And the reason for that is because, of course, humanity has become this absolute, pity-filled, weak herd, where once there stood these warrior class, this elite, this aristocratic species, now is this herd, this giant herd, led by a few priests and shepherds. But it's absolutely fascinating. And Nietzsche's not saying that you're literally above humanity. Of course, everybody is human. He views man as an end to evolution, as the end. But, he says, there is some room for evolution in the social classes, in the way that we conduct ourselves socially. There is room for evolution intellectually, mentally. And that is where he's trying to attack and evolve the reader into a higher class of thinking, into a more naturalistic class of thinking. But this is one of the greatest preambles to one of Nietzsche's greatest texts. Excellent. Thanks.